due to their specialist skill set, he said, and protecting this workforce was crucial to ensuring that safe maternity care can be sustained. Dr. Edward Morris urged unvaccinated pregnant women to urgently get jabbed. Figures show almost a fifth of the most critically ill coronavirus patients in England in recent months were unvaccinated pregnant women. We're seeing higher numbers of pregnant women in critical care than at any other point during the pandemic, and the vast majority of these women are sadly unvaccinated. Vaccination against COVID-19 and flu is the best way for pregnant women to protect themselves and their baby this winter. Both Labour and the Liberal Democrats have called for some Plan B measures to be introduced, and the National Health Service Confederation on Wednesday became the first major organisation to warn that rising cases risk derailing efforts to tackle the backlog. On Sunday, 24th of October, Rishi Sunak announced funding worth almost £6 billion aimed at tackling waiting lists. In an effort to get a grip on the crisis, the Chancellor unveiled plans for investment in the National Health Service capital funding to help deliver about 30% more elective activity by 2024-2025 compared with pre-pandemic levels. This is equivalent to millions more checks, scans and procedures for non-emergency patients. Dr. Catherine Henderson, the president of the Royal College of Emergency Medicine, warned on Sunday, 24th of October, that emergency departments were in a terrible place. She told Sky News' Trevor Phillips on Sunday, "We're already struggling to cope. This is not something that's coming in the next couple of months. We're already in a terrible place where we have got large queues of ambulances with vulnerable people waiting in those ambulances to be offloaded into departments and other patients at home waiting to be picked up by the ambulance. That's the thing that's really worrying me, that these are patients who have not yet received treatment, that we don't necessarily know what's wrong with them, and we're really struggling to get into our healthcare facilities to then work out what we need to do." Prime Minister Boris Johnson has previously said vaccines will get the country through the winter and out of the pandemic. But on Sunday, Professor Adam Finn, who is a member of the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization, said the vaccine program would not be enough to bring infection rates under control. Professor Adam Finn said people should be testing themselves, wearing face masks and avoiding crowds in enclosed spaces in order to prevent a real meltdown in what he described as a worsening situation. "While vaccines were very effective at stopping people from getting seriously ill," he said, "they were not so effective at stopping infections altogether or stopping the virus spreading. They do have an effect on that, but they're not by themselves going to be enough at the present time to keep the spread of the coronavirus under control," he told Sky News' Trevor Phillips. "I would like to re-emphasize the fact that the vaccine program by itself in the current situation, even if things go optimally, is not, in my opinion, enough to bring things under control." Thank you.
Since the rise of Mohammed bin Salman as the Saudi crown prince, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia has tried to offer a rather attractive face of itself through making a number of cosmetic changes. Allowing women to drive for the first time in the history of the kingdom, opening cinemas across the country after decades, and hosting international sporting events are all part of a greater scheme developed by the Saudis in a bid to rebrand their country as a land modern and safe enough for foreign investors. But every now and then, the kingdom rears its ugly head, showing its real colors. The tragic death of Professor Musa Al-Qarni in Dhahban prison once again reminds the international community of the kingdom's grave human rights record. Shortly after the death of Al-Qarni, the Saudi rights group Al-Quds tweeted, "Qarni was subjected to brutal torture, and the Saudi authorities deliberately harmed him by giving him unsuitable medication."
Fortunately, that's not a rarity at all. And you know, to the contrary, for you know, dissenters to go against the KSA and end up dying in custody while undergoing such inhumane treatment and detention is actually something that happens very frequently. If they don't end up meeting their fate by other means, whether it's capital punishment or even, you know, being, as we all saw, assassinated while visiting a Saudi embassy in a foreign country. And, you know, we've seen in recent years frequently the way the regime has treated women's rights activists and other, you know, political prisoners.
This is just the latest example of slow killing of prisoners of conscience Riyadh has long been accused of, blaming the Saudi authorities for violating the standard minimum rules for the treatment of prisoners. Sana'a organization has accused them of following the method of media concealment about the conditions of prisoners of conscience inside the cells of injustice to make their file more complex amid growing concern over their fate.
Oh, well, just earlier this year, there was another case of some Saudi humanitarian aid worker. I believe he worked for Red Crescent, who was sentenced to 20 years in prison and then another 20 years he's forbidden to travel. Even if he survives his sentence and get out, he won't even be able to leave the country. And you know, they tortured him by electrocuting him and flogging him until he signed, you know, a false confession admitting to the bogus charges. And that's just one of many examples. So you know, cases like this are the rule, not the exception. Where jailing of activists, you know, murder of dissidents, repression of women and journalists and anyone who peacefully dissents, that's the norm in Riyadh.
Musa Al-Qarni was born in 1954 in the Jazan region, Saudi Arabia. He obtained his PhD in jurisprudence at Umm Al-Qura University. In 2007, he was arrested and a few years later, in 2011, was sentenced to 15 years in prison, followed by a 20-year travel ban. Among the charges leveled against Al-Qarni were disobeying the king, planning to establish a party, communicating with foreign bodies, attempting to create chaos, and money laundering. Al-Qarni was a member of a group of rights activists who later came to be known as the Jeddah Reformers. The leader of the group, Saud al-Hashimi, received a 30-year prison sentence with a further 30-year travel ban, as well as a fine of 2 million riyals. Saudi Arabia is known across the world as one of the worst rights abusers, where rights advocates are detained and where peaceful activism is treated like an act of terrorism. Mohammed bin Salman's promises of reform soon turn out to be empty, while the macabre murder of Jamal Khashoggi put out the last faint flickers of hope.
We're talking about one of the most oppressive regimes in the world and biggest violators of human rights, not only against other countries like Yemen and Bahrain, but, you know, domestically against their own population. Most famously, as we've seen in the case of the Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi, you know, even when dissidents have been living in self-imposed exile while working for, you know, a flagship Western newspaper, you know, they've made clear that speaking out against the royal family is not tolerated by the House of Saud, which will take, and they're willing to take any and all measures to silence those who would dare defy them.
Among other prominent reformists serving time are Sunni scholars such as Salman al-Oda, Ali al-Omari, and Awad al-Gharni, not to mention Prince Ahmed bin Abdulaziz, bin Salman's own uncle.
And, you know, it doesn't stop there. Even if you're somebody who's wealthy and powerful, you know, bin Salman placed his own cousin, for example, Princess Basma, if I'm saying that right, in prison, you know, just for the crime of advocating women's rights and criticizing the divorce laws. And, you know, she too was held in conditions where on social media, you know, there was posts that were deleted that said her health was deteriorating. So if they don't outright assassinate you, they engage in slow motion assassination, like the case of this cleric where, you know, they detain political prisoners and keep them in conditions so dire and neglect their health. You know, if they don't outright execute you, you'll be killed in slow motion and held in such conditions where their health deteriorates.
By many credible accounts, the deceased academic was exposed to physical and psychological torture for 12 years, and following a deliberate health negligence, he suffered a brain stroke that resulted in his death. On October 19, Prisoners of Conscience tweeted, "Confirmed to us that the cause of Sheikh Musa al-Gharni's death was that he was beaten in the head and face by extremist prisoners as the prison administration placed him with them and refused to transfer him with the elderly." The Saudi authorities reportedly refused to hand over al-Gharni's body to his family, and he was buried in Al-Baghi in the absence of his family and friends. During his time in prison, al-Gharni was reportedly held incommunicado. His family was never allowed to visit him when he was behind bars.
If you look at the creation of the Saudi state, which was essentially, you know, if you look at the way it was formed and the way that its territorial expansion occurred, which was to serve the interests ultimately as a proxy for British imperialism, and then that's continued with America's full spectrum dominance, the way, the purpose that Saudi Arabia served, I don't see any change in leadership coming to the kingdom. And as long as the House of Saud is in power, there's definitely not going to be anything other than these kind of really cosmetic reforms that are mainly, you know, to do things like open the country up to more foreign investment or increase tourism. There's certainly not going to be significant political reforms or any kind of transition to democracy as long as the House of Saud is in power, that's for sure.
To diversify its oil-based economy, the Saudi kingdom has formulated Vision 2030 and spent bags of money on PR exercises. But before anything else, the international community should urge the kingdom to take serious steps in improving human rights and lay it down as a precondition to any future financial interactions.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
The limelight. Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the top House Republican, recently took to social media to warn that Democrats have hatched a dastardly plot. Democrats, he said, want to track every penny you earn so they can then tax you and your family at the maximum possible amount. The article you're about to hear has been published by the New York Times opinion section. The article has been written by Benjamin Applebaum, the lead writer on economics and business for the New York Times editorial board. The piece is titled, "The Rotten Core of the Republican Party." Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the top House Republican, recently took to social media to warn that Democrats have hatched a dastardly plot. Democrats, he said, want to track every penny you earn so they can tax you and your family at the maximum possible amount. Well, yes, Democrats want Americans to pay the full amount they owe in taxes. What doesn't get enough attention is that many Republicans seem not to agree. Resistance to taxation is the rotten core of the modern Republican Party. Republicans in recent decades have sharply reduced the federal income tax rates imposed on wealthy people and big companies. But their opposition to taxation goes beyond that. They are actively aiding and abetting tax evasion. Republicans have hacked away at funding for the Inland Revenue Service, the IRS, over the past decade, enfeebling the agency. When the rich and powerful open loopholes in the tax code, Republicans reliably fight to keep the loopholes open. Indeed, they valorize Americans who find ways to pay less, a normalization of antisocial behavior that may be even more damaging than their efforts at bureaucratic sabotage. Former President Donald Trump's loud and proud declaration that paying very little in taxes makes me smart was just a more brazen articulation of what has become party orthodoxy. The Democratic proposal targeted by Kevin McCarthy in the video he posted online, he actually calls it un-American, would make it harder for wealthy people to cheat on their taxes. The Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, estimated in 2019 that Americans conceal from taxation more than half of income that is not subject to some form of third-party verification, like a W-2, the form that the government uses to verify ordinary wage income. This blind spot costs the federal government hundreds of billions of dollars in unpaid taxes. In comparison, more than 95% of wage income is reported. Under the current version of the Democrats' plan, which is part of the Biden administration's sweeping Build Back Better legislation, banks would be required to submit annual reports on accounts with total inflows and outflows exceeding $10,000, excluding paychecks and government benefits. The banks would report the total amount deposited in the account and the total amount withdrawn. there would be no reporting of individual transactions. The information would give the Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, a better chance to catch cheaters, and it would provide a salutary reminder for people to pay what they owe. The Biden administration recently cemented an international agreement to establish a 15% global minimum tax on corporate income. The long-sought deal would reduce the incentive for American firms to evade taxation by pretending to generate revenue in low-tax havens like Ireland and roughly half of the islands in the Caribbean, a practice that has become all but business as usual in industries with intangible products like finance, technology, and pharmaceutical research. The minimum corporate tax, like the bank reporting requirement, is not aimed at increasing what is owed. It is aimed at collecting what is owed already. Improving tax collection was another important benefit. Democracy and capitalism rest on a lacework of mutual obligation. People fulfill their own responsibilities because they're confident others will too. Collecting taxes, especially from the rich and powerful, is an affirmation of that faith. Felicia Wong, the president of the Roosevelt Institute, a progressive think tank based in New York, said that the corporate tax agreement, which includes 136 countries, is valuable as a demonstration that governments have the ability to impose their will on multinational corporations in the service of the public interest. A hopeful model for confronting other problems like climate change. It can and should create more faith in governance, she said. Both plans, however, must overcome the united opposition of congressional Republicans. The Republican Party was reborn in the 1970s under the banner of resistance to taxation, led by anti-tax men like Jack Kemp and Ronald Reagan. It remains the party's fixation, the one major area of policy on which congressional Republicans were able to agree upon during the Trump administration. By way of ideological justification, Republicans like to talk about liberty, by which they mean a narrow and negative kind of freedom from civic duty and mutual obligation. But the fervent opposition to taxation has always found its deeper wellsprings of motivation in concern about how the money will be spent. In the bellwether case of California, the rise of anti-tax activism was inextricably intertwined with the decline of a white electoral majority. It wasn't a question of whether Americans should ever be required to help one another. The real question was, who would be helped? Opposition to progressive income taxation also draws strength from an imagined democratic ideal in which the people who vote for taxation, pay the taxes, and get the benefits are all one and the same. History tells a very different story, though. From the outset, taxation in the United States was designed as an antidote to inequality. The government initially chose to raise revenue through tariffs, collecting from wealthy merchants. The introduction of a federal income tax in the early 20th century was a different means to the same end. In a historical analysis published last year, a pair of German political scientists, Laura Zielkop and Hannah Leeser, showed that progressive taxation is a hallmark of democratic governance. Political philosophers have long fretted that democracy allows the poor to plunder the rich. Your opposite has proved more nearly true. Progressive taxation is not a threat to the wealthy. It is a small price to pay for prosperity. cutting taxes to staff social programs is by itself a threat to the sustainability of the American experiment in multicultural democracy. In enabling resistance to lawful taxation, Republicans are engaged in an even more direct assault on democracy. Having failed to constrain government spending through the democratic process, they are seeking to undermine government itself. Representative Kevin McCarthy is right to frame a fairly technical change in tax rules as an issue that goes to the heart of American democracy. Democracies impose higher taxes than other forms of government because democracies are communities of common purpose. We create and maintain our society through our contributions. Or we don't, and things fall apart.
There are all kinds of production units in the country. Some manufacture goods we use every day, such as home appliances, automobiles, or apparel, just to name a few. Others produce industrial machinery or even the energy required to power up industrial units. There are also other industrial facilities that produce iron or steel. But one thing all these fields of work have in common is the use of advanced technology used for production. Advanced technology has never been more important than it is today with the fast pace of industry expansion in the country.
Oh, how's it going? Welcome to another edition of Bazaar, your weekly program that analyzes various industries, markets, profits, and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This week, we will explore the manufacturing industry for research-based technologies. We will uncover how companies use the abundant raw material available in the country to produce goods, saving the country billions on imports. Time to enter today's bazaar.
Want to take a particular look at some of the machines and technology that production units use. So our journey took us to Damander Incorporated, which was established over 5 decades ago. From its humble beginnings, this company has grown into a well-established name for fans and blowers. The company is one of the largest manufacturers of electromotors and heating and cooling systems in the West Asian region. It makes over hundreds of types of ventilation systems, original equipment parts, and heating and cooling fans. Basically, fans and blowers are used to move air, gas, or other particles. Its largest fan is the high-tech roof mount centrifugal fan, which is typically used in factories for ventilation. Its products are used in homes, factories, tunnels, and industrial-scale settings. This company has a vast production unit that is located on the outskirts of the capital city, Tehran, and it can produce well over 10,000 units per day and nearly 3 million units annually. Fans are designed by highly experienced mechanical engineers based on the type of application of the fan. Also, this company employs hundreds of other highly specialized personnel.
There are thousands of different fans and blowers in the market for different applications. For instance, kitchen ovens use fans for convection to produce circulating air. In other places, fans are used for ventilation in office buildings or indoor car parks. In general, Iran has little need to import fans unless they are used for special purposes such as power plants or in the oil refining industries.
All manufacturing steps from start to finish are completed at its production facilities. The majority of raw material needed to produce these items are also domestically purchased. However, there is a small percentage of material that is imported for certain specialized fans. This company is registered and certified by Iran's Industrial Research and Standard Institute and has received numerous awards for its high-quality products. It is certified by international standardization bodies and has received various ISO certification for management and quality. One of the competitive advantages of this manufacturer is its decades of experience. This has allowed it to refine its products over the years to produce dependable items with the highest quality. This manufacturer has been exporting its fans and blowers to Central Asia and most neighboring countries, among many others. This company has never stopped expanding throughout the years. It might be interesting to know that this company has been operating throughout several historical eras. It remained active before and during the Islamic Revolution and the 8 years of imposed war with Iraq. And it has continued its activity even through tough imposed economic sanctions. It has been able to overcome these challenges, which it sees as growth opportunities. Iran is a country that is rich in natural reserves. It is fully able to supply raw materials such as steel and petrochemical products to domestic industries. In fact, Iran's steel mills produced over 20 million tons of steel in the first 8 months of this year. This shows an almost 10% increase in productions since 2020 and a growing domestic demand. Iran ranks as the world's 10th biggest crude steel producer by a recent report by the World Steel Association. China was the top producer of steel, followed by India, Japan, and the United States. Based on figures from Iran's Steel Producers Association, around 15 million tons worth $7 billion of steel can be exported annually. The Iranian steel industry has been constantly developing over the past years. This is despite all the pressures and obstacles created by outside forces like the US sanctions and the coronavirus outbreak. On another note, Iran is also a large producer of petrochemical products as well. The country has a capacity to produce some 60 million tons worth of petrochemical products. That's based on figures from the Iranian Oil, Gas, and Petrochemical Products Exporters Union. According to these statistics, around 28 million tons of these products were produced last year. Of this amount, around 8 million tons were domestically consumed, and 20 million tons were exported to countries around the world. Industry associations estimate that Iran can potentially export $50 billion worth of these items each year.
So, in terms of raw material, Iranian manufacturers are mostly dependent on local productions of raw material to make their products. But not all products are equal. Some require more research and development to add value, which increases their sales profits. These items are usually advanced technologies that are created to serve very special needs in the industry.
The number of knowledge-based companies has increased over the years with a strong engineering base in the country. If there were 50 high-tech firms in 2013, now there are 125 times more than that number in 2021. Currently, there are over 6,200 high-tech firms and knowledge-based companies across the country. The company we mentioned earlier in the program is just one example of a diverse range of high-tech manufacturers. By indigenizing various technologies to meet domestic needs, these companies have saved the country millions in capital flight. Based on statistics from the Science and Technology Office of the Vice Presidency, some 40 knowledge-based companies are listed in the stock market. This is part of an initiative implemented by the government to increase capital in support of hard work of knowledge-based manufacturers. Also, the Central Bank of Iran has distributed some $3 billion in loans to high-tech firms and research companies to help facilitate their growth. Other plans are underway with the office incorporating with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to boost exports of technology and production know-how. Exports are projected to reach pre-sanctions level with a value of over $1 billion by the end of this year. That's according to the Vice Presidential Office for Science and Technology.
Well, it is time for me to take a break and pass the action over to my good friend and colleague who will bring to you an educational report.
It was around 2,000 years ago when paper was first invented, something which marked man's giant leap in the learning process, for it allowed ideas to be recorded and easily passed on to others. Today, educational supplies are not limited to papers, and companies like EEI are working on a daily basis to design stuff that turn learning into a hobby. Stay with me to learn more about this Iranian company.
Educational Equipment Industries Company, or shortly EEI, was launched in 1974. It is a leading designer, manufacturer, and a distributor of educational and training instruments for schools, universities, and vocational training centers in Iran. It also produces scientific entertainment games and training toys and designs brain teasers for out-of-class activities. Learning is easier with games. This is one of the mottos of the company. EEI produces toys that make complicated scientific subjects easier to grasp for children. With a dedicated R&D team constantly monitoring the market, Educational Equipment Industries Company tries to stay up to date and tap into technological advances to produce smarter products.
The company tries to catch up with modern trends in education to tailor its products to modern demands. For example, over the past decades, it has been producing conventional microscope. But now, it is producing this digital microscope, which displays the image on a monitor and allows both users and the audience to view the image immediately and analyze it.
With such a diverse array of educational supplies, the ambitious company says it is eyeing for a larger market by scouting for international clients. Beside its bid to gain worldwide recognition, EEI tries to take education to the next level by exploring innovative ways to facilitate learning. It is planning to launch a production line of educational tablets that make school material fun to learn.
With an experience stretching for half a century, the Iranian brand says it commits itself to adapting to modern trends in education. It says this is to fulfill its goal of making learning an enjoyable experience for all generations.
Many thanks for that wonderful adventure. Great stuff. So let's dive right into some news and trends regarding Iran's high-tech industries and manufacturers. One of the current trends we are seeing is the government's keenness to help knowledge-based companies increase their exports. The Science and Technology Office has launched several plans and programs that provide special support to these companies.
One of the biggest programs in the works is to help companies with standardizations. This program assesses compatibility of Iranian knowledge-based products with global markets through the World Trade Organization standards. The plan also aims to attract foreign investment and the participation of Iranians who live abroad. Government officials and industry participants say this is a significant step which keeps Iranian products relevant in the international arena.
The atmosphere of Iran's tech industries is buzzing with growth. And Iran is looking to strengthen its regional collaborations in the field of information and communications technologies, or ICT.
Iran's ICT minister participated in the annual Transportation and Communication Forum in Turkey this year. Isa Zarepour introduced several Iranian ICT products and talented tech firms at the forum. the minister also signed an agreement with his Turkish counterpart to implement joint projects for cybersecurity measures and other ICT developments. Other topics that were discussed included border transit and the establishment of joint border data centers. The forum centered around the theme of logistics mobility digitalization. It was attended by representatives from 55 countries worldwide.
A major Iranian copper producer has offered large investments to companies in the field of high-tech manufacturing to upgrade its aging facilities.
The goal is to encourage tech firms and startups to present innovative solutions to the sector's age-old technological gaps. This initiative will help introduce domestic industries with tech investment opportunities, which will also focus on the tech ecosystem's target markets. The copper producer says incorporating cutting-edge technologies will have a positive direct impact on other fields. So far, 7 contracts worth $2 million have been signed with tech companies and the copper producer. This investment plan was also facilitated by Iran's National Innovation Fund.
By the way, and I want to tell you about Iran's drug production on this episode of Bazaar. Iran has been under heavy sanctions, yes. But the country's drug production capacity is really high. Different factories with an impressively high production capacity are at work. Some make up to 200 types of medicine, some of which are produced under foreign licenses in Iran. Apart from regular medicines such as antibiotics and over-the-counter painkillers, Iran has managed to enter the realm of complex medicine, such as radiopharmaceuticals and biologic drugs for special illnesses. To familiarize you with these realms, we paid a visit to Osve Company.
We're talking an area on Tehran's outskirts, an area packed with factories, automobile factories, and pharmaceutical, petrochemical, and clothes factories, among others. It's an area to the west of Tehran, close to Alborz province. Our intended factory is also on a road to Alborz province, the Osve Pharmaceutical Factory, with a varied range of drugs to produce. Osve is a public stock company. It was established as early as 1966, but it has managed to adapt to new research and findings. For example, a medicine this company is proud to have produced in Iran is Deferasirox. Its non-generic name is Osvarol, and what it does is it reduces blood iron levels for patients in need of long blood transfusions, such as patients suffering from thalassemia or chronic low blood counts. It makes medicine to control blood pressure and to cure migraine, insomnia and depression, nephrology, diabetes and blood lipids. It also makes various vitamins. A common ailment among Iranians is high blood pressure due to their high levels of salt consumption and sedentary lifestyles. A third of Iranians over 30 suffer from this. At least 100,000 people allegedly die from high blood pressure each year. The health ministry has done a lot to control this, but 40% of people with high blood pressure don't even know they have it. But what has Osve done for those suffering from it?
You are all aware not everyone exercises to need just dietary supplements. Many an ailment can be prevented with a little exercise, but too many people are too busy for that. There are those illnesses that have nothing to do with exercise, however, but are hereditary. For those, plenty of medicine is needed. But drug consumption is generally high in Iran, such that Iran ranks 20 among countries of the world, with each Iranian annually consuming 4 times as much medicine as the world standard. Iran, with its 80 million population, consumes as much medicine as China, with its population of 1.3 billion. But does this mean Iranians get ill more often? No, actually. It's just that their use of drugs is unregulated. And to meet their demand, Iran has plenty of pharmaceutical factories active in research and expansion and quality production. They even export some of their items manufactured.
Going by the statistics of Iran's Food and Drug Administration, about 95% of drugs required domestically are produced in Iran. In the early days of the Islamic Revolution, Iran produced only about 500 drugs. But now, this country's producing 3,000 drugs in 4,000 pharmaceutical variations. Iran has at present 15 pharmaceutical faculties, which train scores of pharmacists and researchers each year. Also, over 100 drug distributing companies are active in Iran today. In spite of the glittering statistics, however, there are those who say some 40% of the raw material for these drugs are imported from mainly India. But the Ministry of Health counts these drugs as part of the same 95% domestic produce. And there are the many who believe it's altogether irrelevant where the raw material comes from, because the art of pharmacology is to know how to mix those raw materials. Also, to domestically produce all the raw material needed may not even be cost efficient. The biggest obstacle to the Iranian industry, such as the pharmaceutical industries, is cruel US sanctions. US authorities have time and again stressed that Iran's pharmaceutical sector is exempt from sanctions. But imposing sanctions on the finance and money transfer sector is practically as good as boycotting the pharmaceutical sector. This hypocritical act by both Democrat and Republican US officials has caused hundreds of patients to die. Patients whose medicine Iran has not yet managed to make domestic, that is, to adapt as native to Iran. In spite of all this pressure, Iranian companies have managed even to export their produce. These exports have also been touched by US sanctions, however. This is while Iran's domestic drug market is worth $4.5 billion, and it is said Iranian-produced drugs are twice the country's domestic need. In other words, Iran could easily satisfy regional countries' pharmaceutical needs if only US sanctions could have been omitted from the equation. This company has enjoyed many achievements in Iran, but even on an international scale, it has acquired 2 licenses for innovation, health and safety, and quality from the German ICS Group.
Modern pharmaceutical methods are a continuation of that path, but with greater precision and the use of chemistry. But with yet greater scientific advancement, today medicine is made with proteins derived from living cells cultured in the lab. This is called biopharmacology. You may have heard the names of some of these biopharmaceuticals, such as hormones like insulin or growth hormones, blood factor vaccines for anemia stemming from hepatitis B, and several other names to cure tough-to-treat illnesses. These drugs have been effective in curing common forms of cancer, such as breast cancer, in chemotherapy, in curing several arthritis of the joints, chronic kidney failure, and several other ailments. Knowledge-based companies in Iran have managed to make over 20 base or blueprint medicines, and Iran is a forerunner in biopharmaceuticals. Such medicines are about 146 worldwide, and Iran aims to bring its figures up to 40 soon. These drugs will be much cheaper than their foreign equivalents. Iran these days has managed to export its drugs to some 17 countries, and given its biopharmaceutical know-how, it has succeeded in greatly alleviating its patients' pain. A prominent company in this field is Synergen. Amir Mehdi Kazemi, a dear friend, visited this company to learn about the range of its products. Don't miss this report, because you're in for a surprise.
Less than 3 decades ago, a big idea came to the minds of a group of Iranian biotechnologists. The aim was to help cure patients with chronic diseases in Iran and across the world. That was a turning point for the pharmaceutical industry of Iran. A few years later, the same group of scientists, who were now joined by a considerable number of their colleagues, decided to establish a center for the production of biopharmaceuticals, a company which today takes its steps on the edge of science. People here believe that their ambition is beyond imagination. In the year 2000, Synergen took the first steps towards producing recombinant proteins and monoclonal antibodies aimed at manufacturing biopharmaceuticals. Today, a diverse range of biomedicines are produced at this facility near Karach City, about 50 kilometers west of the capital, Tehran.
The novel idea of making such a company came about 25 years ago with the novel idea of a group of young scientists. Actually, we manufacture a huge basket of different products in the field of biosimilars. We are a market leader.
We take a look into the most advanced biopharmaceutical facility in the Middle East, a maze of high-tech clean rooms and laboratories where some of the world's latest technologies are being used. Recombinant DNA technology is a technique that introduces the gene of interest in a host, which in this case is Chinese hamster ovary or bacterial cells. It all starts from the cell culture department, where recombinant cells are fed and grown in what is known as a culture media to produce the protein of interest and the biopharmaceutical used for treatment of a particular disease. The medicine is then extracted from a complex mixture and purified using chromatography steps and purification techniques. Thousands of square meters of clean room space, dozens of bioreactor containers, and elite staff wearing special suits, an environment rarely seen anywhere else in the Middle East. Currently, the team of experts at the company take their steps shoulder to shoulder with their counterparts in the U.S. and Europe, observing international quality and state-of-the-art good manufacturing practices, or GMP standards, has enabled the company to supply a part of the world markets with medicines that offer the same quality of their reference products with competitive prices.
Actually, in this department, we control or reject the quality of the product, even the packaging material or anything that comes into the production area and quality control area, based on the guidelines and regulation in the world class. And that's how we get the GMP certificate from the top regulatory bodies.
The manufacturing of sophisticated medicines for the treatment of incurable diseases such as multiple sclerosis and cancer, as well as other maladies like osteoporosis, anemia, and renal failure, are no longer under the monopoly of pharmaceutical giants in the West. In fact, new powerful players are emerging with new ambitions that include sharing their sciences with others and helping to cure patients in less prosperous societies across the world next to their commercial objectives.
Many thanks once again. Don't forget to leave your comments on our social pages, as your opinions will help us improve. Till next week, when we'll introduce you to other Iranian products, goodbye and God be with you.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
The new report has a stark scientific message for climate change negotiators at COP26, said the head of the World Meteorological Organization. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Andrea Germanes, journalist. This article is published under the heading Humanity Way Off Track. WMO says atmospheric carbon at level unseen in 3 million years. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Carbon dioxide concentrations reached a new record high in 2020, with comparable levels not seen for roughly 3 million years, the United Nations Weather Agency said recently. The findings came in the latest edition of the World Meteorological Organization's Greenhouse Gas Bulletin, released a week before COP26, the UN Climate Summit, kicks off in Glasgow. According to WMO Secretary General Professor Petteri Talas, the report holds a stark scientific message for climate change negotiators headed to the summit. The bulletin said globally average levels of CO2 as well as two other potent greenhouse gases, methane and nitrous oxide, were all up from the previous year. CO2 reached 413.2 parts per million ppm in 2020, 149% of the pre-industrial level. The increase from 2019 levels came despite pandemic-triggered lockdowns, triggering an approximately 5.6% drop in fossil fuel CO2. Methane stood at 262% and nitrous oxide at 123% of pre-industrial levels, the report said. At the current rate of increase in greenhouse gas concentrations, we will see a temperature increase by the end of this century far in excess of the Paris Agreement targets of 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, he said in a statement warning we are way off track. The amount of CO2 in the atmosphere breached the milestone of 400 parts per million in 2015, and just 5 years later, it exceeded 413 ppm, Talas added. This is more than just a chemical formula and figures on a graph. It has major negative repercussions for our daily lives and well-being, for the state of our planet, and for the future of our children and grandchildren, he added.